Often, behind a great restaurant is a great chef. But that chef would be nothing without the scores of people in the front and the back of the house who turn a meal into a memorable experience. Coming up next on Louisiana Eats, we're getting to know some of the unsung heroes of hospitality, beginning with the senior line cook at Commander's Palace, Chef Serene Mabe.
Can't was never part of my vocabulary. As tough as it get, I knew that the result of it would be great. So just keep fighting, and then someday I'll fly.
Then we meet Sterling Constant, who's been serving guests at Antoine's restaurant for 50 years.
I don't put a movie star in front of any of the guests. The guest that I'm serving is important to me.
We're turning the tables on this week's Louisiana Eats. That's coming up next. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The confirmation hearing for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh continues on Capitol Hill this hour. Senators have pointed questions for the nominee, but as NPR's Windsor Johnson tells us, Kavanaugh is not giving them all the answers they want.
When asked about his position on Roe versus Wade, Kavanaugh would only say legalized abortion is an established constitutional right and important precedent. He later sidestepped a question from Senator Dianne Feinstein about whether a sitting president can be indicted.
My understanding is that you're asking me to give my view on a potential hypothetical, and that's something that each of the eight justices currently sitting on the Supreme Court, when they're sitting in my seat, declined to decide potential hypothetical cases.
Kavanaugh was also asked whether a president has the authority to pardon someone in exchange for a promise not to testify against him. He declined to answer. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
Members of another Senate panel are considering today's testimony from executives of Facebook and Twitter over the measures they've taken to protect people's accounts from being hacked or co-opted by foreign operatives with a political agenda. Facebook's number two executive, Sheryl Sandberg, appeared months after the company conceded Facebook was slow in identifying Russia's efforts to manipulate Facebook before and after the 2016 presidential election.
We are more determined than our opponents, and we will keep fighting. When bad actors try to use our site, we will block them. When content violates our policies, we will take it down.
Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey appeared alongside Sandberg to address concerns about his platform. From his phone at the witness table, Dorsey tweeted some of his opening statements. It reads, "We are not proud of how that free and open exchange has been weaponized and used to distract and divide people." Dorsey appears before a House committee this hour to address allegations that social media companies have displayed bias against conservatives. A notable absence, by the way, at the Senate hearing was that of Google, which lawmakers from both parties criticized. UK Prime Minister Theresa May says two officers with Russian military intelligence known as the GRU flew to England last March and poisoned an ex-Russian spy and his daughter. NPR's Frank Langford has the latest on this from London.
May said police tracked the movements of the men from a London hotel room where they found traces of the nerve agent Novichok all the way to the city of Salisbury near the home of ex-spy Sergei Skripal, the morning of the poisoning.
We know that the GRU has played a key part in malign Russian activity in recent years. And today we have exposed their role behind the despicable chemical weapons attack on the streets of Salisbury. The actions of the GRU are a threat to all our allies and to all our citizens.
The UK is charging the men, who went by the names Alexander Petrov and Ruslan Bosharov, in absentia with attempted murder. Frank Langford, NPR News, London.
This is NPR. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals is blocking cities from prosecuting the homeless for sleeping on streets. Matt Gillum with Boise State Public Radio has details.
The decision stems from a lawsuit brought against the city of Boise by six homeless people in 2009 over an ordinance prohibiting sleeping in public spaces. At the time, lawyers for the indigent group said some 4,500 homeless people were left without a place to stay. They asserted Boise shelters only had sleeping provisions for about 700 people. The city updated its policies in 2014 but set limits on how long the homeless could stay in shelters. Another issue, the majority of facilities require participation in religious-based programs. The Ninth Circuit found the homeless were still at risk of prosecution even when room was available in shelters. The court also took issue with the religious curriculum at the facilities. The court says Boise's rules violate the Eighth Amendment and constitute cruel and unusual punishment. The ruling could reverberate across the nation as many cities deal with increasing homeless populations. For NPR News, I'm Matt Gilliman, Boise.
Bob Woodward's new book about the Trump presidency finds itself the target of more Twitter tirade from the White House today. President Trump says he is the exact opposite of how Woodward portrays him and blames accounts in the book on disgruntled former employees. Woodward cites disparaging remarks that the current chief of staff, John Kelly, and the current defense secretary, Jim Mattis, purportedly said about the president. Mattis says the Trump insults attributed to him were never uttered by him or in his presence. U.S. stocks mixed this hour. The Dow is up 17 points at 25,969. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Craig Newmark Foundation, committed to the values of fairness, opportunity, and respect. The Newmark Foundation supports veterans and military families, voting rights, truth in journalism, and women in tech.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Zatarain's, maker of New Orleans pantry staples like Creole mustard, fish fry, and jambalaya mix since 1889. Recipes and more at Zatarain's.com. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. As we move through the world, our lives are filled with chance acquaintances. Strangers bumping into strangers sometimes magically opens doors and changes lives forever. That's certainly the case with New Orleanian Cliff Hall and Senegalese cook Serene Mabe. On this week's show, we'll hear the story of what began as a chance conversation in Africa and ended in the kitchen at Commander's Palace in New Orleans. Then, over the last 50 years, you may have encountered Sterling Constant at Antoine's restaurant. Whether by chance or by reservation, it's a sure bet that your meal, as orchestrated by this amazing career waiter, provided a respite from the day and quite possibly an element of magic as well. We'll visit Sterling at Antoine's and hear about a life of service well led. We're turning the tables on this week's Louisiana Eats.
My name is Serene Mabe. My name stands for love and peace and kind. And I try to live by that. I try to lead by example by my name.
Chef Serene Mabe is the senior line cook at Commander's Palace, whose personal journey took him from his birthplace in New York to a Hard Knocks boarding school in Senegal to New Orleans, with many stops in between.
I was born in New York City, Harlem. I grew up in a big family. And at the age of 5, my parents took me back to Senegal because at the time I was the youngest. And it was much easier to send the young kids and leave the old ones because all my other brothers were around 10, 11 at the time. So they could basically sort of kind of take care of themselves. They don't need much babysit. So they took me to Africa by the age of 5, and I was in a boarding school for about 9 years going on 10. And throughout that 10 years of time, I barely saw both my parents within 10 years.
Oh my goodness.
Saw my dad probably twice before I finished boarding school. Saw my mother about 5 to 6 times.
Serene, this must have been a huge culture shock coming from your family in New York, and then you end up in Senegal, and the family's gone, and you're all alone. It must have been really a scary experience.
For sure. I mean, I definitely don't regret nothing that happened because it definitely made me the man I am today. But living it was something that I don't want to see no other kid live it. You know, the torture was beyond, how can I say it? It was beyond ridiculous. It was just, you basically wake up at 5 a.m. every day, and breakfast and lunch was never guaranteed based on your lesson. So if you didn't complete your lesson at a certain time and breakfast come around, you will pass breakfast for that day. And lunch come around and you haven't memorized your lesson, forget about lunch. So dinner was something that was always there.
Oh.
It was very brutal. It was hard. We used to get hit a lot. You know, it was similar to, I remember one time me and a friend of mine went to a movie theater. We saw this movie, 12 Years a Slave, and it reminded me so much of that. It was not far from it, you know. When I was 9 years old, back in Senegal, in the boarding school, a great way to get away from the torture and the abuse and everything else is to develop a cooking skills, because if you knew how to cook, it was a way to get away. And at the age of 9, I cooked for 600 people, made dinner. So whether it's good or not, people ate it because that's the only thing they got.
Now, how did you happen to cook for 600 people when you were 9 years old?
So it was not, I was not preparing an entree. It was mostly dinner. So it was this thing called alach, which is pretty much kind of like oatmeal, which is pretty much easy to make. But I always had the amazing touch to it that people always love when I prepare it. So it was great. So at the age of 14, 15, that's when I kind of returned back to America. And that's when I started living with my parents again. But when I came back to America, things were not easy. It was much more difficult because now they put me in high school with these kids that been going to school since kindergarten to freshman to sophomore. And I missed out close to 10 years of education. You expect me to be in the same classroom with them and perform the same academic level as me, which was impossible. Freshman year was difficult because I couldn't even understand what the teacher is saying. At the age of 14, I did not know how to write my name in English. My mother moved out of New York, went to Connecticut, and at the time it did not benefit me. So I told her that I have to finish high school in New York. So I was living on my own and working full time and still have to support myself. And I was a dishwasher at the time, and I was getting paid $7.25 an hour.
Oh, my goodness.
And in New York City, I had to pay, I think, $7.50 a month. So I was studying and almost time. I don't want to share certain things in the radio.
No, I understand.
You don't have to put this, but I almost wanted to give up life.
I understand.
It was hard. But
it must have been so, because you must have felt so alone, you know.
It was definitely detrimental, you know. It was hard. I was upset. But by my senior year of high school, I was definitely honor student. Over years, I definitely just been researching and just believed in what I believed in. So I was living on my own and working as a dishwasher in New York City. You know how rough that could be. But every time when I see the chef plate, it just reminds me of when I was young, how people had so much frustration, and until they eat a meal, you know, they just change their whole perspective. That's how I feel every time. Until I was given opportunity to work in the garmanger. And my first day, I cut myself 9 times.
Oh, 9 times? And they kept you on in that position?
Of course not. I got moved back to dishwasher. I mean, but not for long, because I began to researching and studying about culinary in general. And until I was given another opportunity to start on pastry, which is much simpler than Grand Manger.
And less knife work.
Yeah, less knife work, for sure. That's for sure. Until one time... until we had a chance to do an event at James Beard House in New York City. And that just changed my whole view.
How old were you then?
I was about 19.
And what happened that night that changed your view?
First, when I stepped into James Beard House, the book, the inspiration, the lights, the ambiance, I just looked at food from a different perspective that I never imagined that food could be looked in that sort of way. So it literally took me to a different world, a different place. I knew then that cooking is something that I wanted to do. I was always close to my mom when I was young, so I always helped her when she had a guest or anytime she cooked around the kitchen. And one Thanksgiving, within that same year, my mother didn't make a Thanksgiving, and the turkey was at the house. Nobody cooked it. I didn't have much experience, but I knew how to cook a chicken. So I cooked the turkey, not knowing what I was doing, just following my heart.
Uh-huh.
And when it came out, everybody loved it. And the excitement I got from all my siblings, it made me realize that I want to do this for the rest of my career. At that moment, within that same year, I knew that cooking is something that I really wanted to do.
So you graduate from high school and
right.
You're working in restaurants.
Right.
Where does your journey take you?
Well, after I graduated high school, I worked at a Mediterranean and Japanese restaurant in New York City. From Japanese, I worked at a Cuban restaurant where I added Spanish to my repertoire. I worked there for about 6-7 months. And from there, I had a chance to work for an Italian restaurant in New York City. And this Italian restaurant had about 10, 11 pasta, all homemade. I just fell in love. And I was in a pasta station. It was difficult. It was hard. Each thing of pasta had their own ingredients, but I loved it. It was very intense. After I completed culinary school, I was supposed to go to Paris for an internship, and it didn't work out as planned it. And I was so frustrated. I didn't want to stay in New York. So I left New York, went to Cleveland, Ohio, and worked for Top 1 Best Restaurant and Top 2 at the same time. In 6 months working in Cleveland, I was frustrated because now I graduated culinary school, working in these restaurants, and I feel like I wasn't learning as much.
Mm-hmm.
And I was researching about West African chef. Miraculously, I find this chef named Chef Pierre Cham. And I find out he had 2 books. His first book won the Julia Child cover page, and second book got nominated for James Beard Award. And I follow him through social media, reach out to him, not expecting him to respond back to me, but miraculously he did. And we talked. It was a very short conversation. But he told me that it would be a great idea to go back to your roots. And it took me a while to really understand what he was trying to say. And one time I just called my dad, and he told me that he's going to Senegal that same week. I was like, well, I want to go to Senegal too. Because I have not gone back since I've been back to America for about 8 years, going on 9. And I purchased my ticket right there and then. Just finally going back to Senegal.
Some people live for the fortune. Some people live just for the fame.
When we come back from a short break, our conversation with Chef Serene Mabe continues. Stay tuned.
Some people live just to play the game. Some people think that the physical things define what's within.
Hi, folks, this is Bill from the Dirty Rice Show. And I'd like to let y'all know that Dirty Rice has reverted back to its original 2-hour format. That's right, we're going to be on the air from 9 until 11 p.m. every Saturday night right here on KRVS. So won't you join either myself or my co-host, Mr. Lee Klein, Peter, for 2 hours of Dirty Rice, 9 to 11, KRVS, 88.7 FM, KRVS.org.
Later today on This American Life, Michael Lewis tells the incredible story of how a teenage boy made it into college, into Harvard, no less, thanks to a stolen library book in another language, and real essays and emails sent to college admissions officers, including one from a parent that begins, "My second grader has decided on a career in electrical engineering. He is leaning towards MIT. As schools start, how I got into college, later today.
Coming up tonight at 7 on KRVS. Hi, this is Dan Phillips inviting you to Funkify Your Life Thursday afternoons at 1 and Friday nights at 9 right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets, from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and from the Napoleon House, located in the historic New Orleans French Quarter, home of the Pimm's Cup cocktail and the toasted muffalata. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 500 Charter Street. Do you have some Louisiana eats on your mind? We'd like to hear about it, so we opened a phone line to take your calls. Leave us a message at 504-867-9128 or send us an email to louisianaeats@poppytooker.com. And now, back to Louisiana Eats. If you're just joining us, we've been speaking with Senegalese chef Serene Mabe, a senior line cook at Commander's Palace. Serene, how did you end up in New Orleans?
Well, I went to Senegal last summer, and I was there for about a month and a half, and I went to all of the places I known for food, learn, teach, went to culinary school out there, show a little demo about Italian and French cuisine, what I learned over the past in culinary school. And I also went to a lot of my grandma's and a lot of different villages to learn about really what's African cuisine. As I thought about it, I was like, wow, we have all these ingredients that we have in Senegal, but never been discovered as fine dine. You know, it just is absent. At that moment, I knew that when I came back to America, things was going to be different. So how I ended up in New Orleans was my flight from Senegal back to New York City. I met this nonprofit organization called Giving Hope, and I was introduced to Cliff.
Cliff Hall.
Cliff Hall, correct. He was one of the part owners of a New Orleans fish house. I met him in Senegal. And
How did that happen to come about?
It was pretty funny because when I got to the airport, I saw this group of people. And so I think to myself, I thought they were French. And I started hearing them speaking English, and I was, "Will you guys speak English?" And they were surprised that I spoke English because I'm in Senegal. You know, it was colonized by French, so you would have thought that French was the language they spoke. And they were surprised that I spoke English. So I was like, "Well, you speak English?" I was like, "Yeah." And then they started asking me stories and how I grew up, stuff like that, where I'm from, and when and why I was in Senegal. And when I mentioned that I was in culinary, immediately I was introduced to Cliff. And he asked me about my story. At the airport, Cliff just started tearing. And he was just so thrown with my story. And he wanted me to come to New Orleans to work for Commander's Palace. At that time, I didn't know who is Commander's Palace.
What is that?
Yeah, what is Commander's Palace? Until I went home, researched about Commander's, looked up the chef, which is Chef Tari, and I said to myself, this would be something different. And also, when the slave left from West Africa, New Orleans was the first place they arrived in. So I had to understand that connection.
It was another part of your roots in essence.
For sure. And when I came here, the original plan was to be here 3 months. But that definitely did not happen. For sure.
So you come here and you already knew that you had a position at Commander's. Did they agree to give you a job?
Commander's had hired me from New York. So I got called from one of the sous chefs, and I was working at New York at the time, and my executive asked me, "You can't be on the phone." But I definitely knew that, but I knew that I saw 504, and then I knew that it was New Orleans area code. So I picked up the phone. I said, "Hey, chef, it's very important. It's gonna be a second." He's like, "All right, go ahead, take your time." And then it was like, "Hey, my name is such and such, and I'm a chef at Commander's Palace, and I want you to come down here and then see how you like it. Within that same week, I bought my ticket, flew down on Tuesday. On a Wednesday, I was on the schedule. When I came into the kitchen, I was so blown by it. I was like, I never saw a kitchen that big. You know, and the fact that they let a guest walk in the kitchen, I'm like, what are they doing at first? But I realized that this was something different. And when I came from New York to Commander's, I wanted to cook. I didn't, you know, I had experience of a cook, at least as a cook. But they started me at desserts, which is basically a commis from like the bottom part. But I was able to work my way up as a cook pretty quickly. Kept my head down, listened to people that had been there longer, my seniority cooks and seniority sous chefs. And opportunity just occurred, and I've just been taking it step by step. Even though I'm young, but I experienced so much that a person that's probably 30 haven't experienced, you know? Because a lot of people say that in order for you to be successful, you have to put in the time, you know? If you think about Michael Jackson, for example, out of age of 20, he put in work, the amount of practice, the amount of work he put in. A person that's 40 years old at that time have not put in that amount of work. For me, I feel like the same thing. I always, even when I was in New York, I always worked at two jobs at once. At the same time, I was always studying. How can I better myself? So a person that have the same amount of years of experience culinary than I have, I always felt that I have more experience than they do, because it was not, for me, it was not more of a job. This was something, it was a lifestyle, something I had, you know? Every time I put on a chef coat, it's always a desire that comes with it, you know? For me, it's like when a doctor put on his shirt about to do a big surgery. That's how I always look at it, because cooking is something that is very important to me, because at a certain age back home in Senegal, I was not able to eat whenever I want. Now I'm given a chance to cook for others. I definitely want to give them a dining memory, you know? So I always give something, I always give them a piece of serene, something that they could take with them, and hopefully they could get knowledge out of it, you know? And something that they could also connect to. Pain is temporary. It might last a minute, hours, days, seconds, sometimes years. So mine's, I feel like, with years. But eventually it's going to subside and something else is going to take its place. But if you quit, however, it will last forever. So I always had in my mind that can't was never my part of my vocabulary. You know, so I always, as tough as it get, I knew that the result of it would be great. So just keep fighting and then someday I'll fly.
Well, I simply can't wait to watch what happens next in your life. So
sure.
Stay in touch, and thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I truly appreciate being here and sharing my story.
Chef Serene Mabe, a senior line cook at Commander's Palace.
My name is Cliff Hall. I'm vice president and partner at New Orleans Fish House.
After hearing Serene's version of his life-altering chance encounter with Cliff Hall, we simply had to sit down with Cliff and hear his side of this amazing accidental meeting.
Well, it's crazy, and I don't try to put religious belief on anyone, but I do believe that on this particular day, the stars aligned for something really special to happen. And I was actually in Africa. I had gone on a missions trip with Troy Duhon, who is the originator and starter of Giving Hope Foundation. And being on the board there, we had chosen Gambia, Africa, to place an orphanage in. And so there was a team of us there going for a ribbon cutting to open that orphanage in a very poor area in Gambia. So in our travels back, we were in an airport. And as you well know, when you go from country to country, customs is very, very tight. And it just so happened that Serene was actually coming back to New York while we were flying back from Africa as well. And one of my friends was actually behind him in the line and just struck up a conversation. Hey, young man, what are you doing? Well, you know, what's your story? What you doing here? And he explained to my friend Mark that he had just gone back to Senegal to cook and to see family and to just kind of encourage kids in the schooling system there that he had come from, that you don't have to remain poor, that there is hope, that no matter what your story is and no matter what struggle you may have, that you control your own destiny. You can fight your way out. He actually did it with his passion for food.
What an incredible man he is.
It is. And to do it at such a young age and to have maturity and not take the negative in his life and use that and allow that to destroy him, but yet to motivate and drive fire and passion in him to not be defeated and to find something that he loved, in which ended up being cooking and becoming a chef. And he used that passion and that love for food. He's just one incredible person. You know, as we waited, I was introduced to him by Mark because Mark said, well, you're a chef. You've got to meet my friend Cliff Hall, who is really instrumental in the New Orleans market for seafood and has been some time. And so we got to spend 2.5 hours in the holding room before we could go on the plane. Once we got through custom, it just was that long. And it took me about 15 minutes of conversation with him to see and to realize that this young man is special and that I didn't feel like it was an accident. And if there was anything that I could do to help him, that I would, because he wanted to be so diverse in learning, you know, his food skills. And he had been in New York and graduated from school and had that. And I'm like, man, you got to come to New Orleans. And he's like, you know, that would be interesting. So when I got back, I couldn't get him off my mind. And I called Tori McPhail at Commanders. And Tori and I have been very good friends for a long time. And I said, Chef, I have never asked you for a favor, but I've got one that I'd like to ask you. And he said, my friend, exactly what he said, what do you need? And I said, I met this young man, and I really believe he's got the fire in his belly to learn and to better himself, and he's special. There's something unique about him. And I would like for you to give him a shot here at Commander's Palace. And so because of our friendship and a trust factor, we got his resume in their hands. They looked at it, and he said, I would like for you to have him here next Wednesday from when I first conversation with him for orientation. And so Chef hired him sight unseen. And I'll tell you, if you get a chance to talk to him, he'll just explain to you, just like I'm saying, how special of a person Serene is.
Serene, we know, very independent, very capable person. Did you have any further hand in helping him make the move or acclimate once he got here?
Well, I sponsored him for 2 months. I put him up and paid for his rent for 2 months so that he could get here, get acclimated. He actually lived with another employee at Commander's who was just generous enough, sight unseen again, the stars lining up, to let him move into his house. And the guy that he roomed with thanked me for introducing him, because now they're friends. And the last time that I was in Commander's with Chef, and Serene was on the line, Chef put his arm around me, goes, man, thank you so much. You know, he makes everybody better around him. And so not only does he have a passion and a love for what he does, he takes that passion and he looks to make those around him better, which, you know, that speaks so highly, not just of his talent, but of the person that he is.
Cliff, I'm fascinated that, you know, obviously you are a person who puts their money where their mouth is, or you wouldn't have been on that mission trip in Africa. You wouldn't have been involved in the work that you're involved in. Is it unusual for you to suddenly pluck some young man out of the air, move him to New Orleans, and help support him? Or have you had Have you had similar projects, or was this just really sort of an act of God?
No, this I would declare as an act of God, just the way it all happened. And, you know, we chose – what even ties it even more special is we chose to put the orphanage in Gambia because African slaves that came from Africa to our region here came from Gambia and Senegal, from the Wolof tribe. They were brought to Algiers Point, and there is literally a placard on the levee in Algiers Point stating that this is where the African slaves were brought and dropped, and then they were boated across the river and sold around the Cafe Masparia area. And the Africans that were there were the Wolof tribe was one of the main tribes. And so that even ties Serene even more because as I got into, I'm like, this is incredible, this story building. So I'm like, he tells him he speaks five languages. And so I'm like, well, what are the five languages that you speak? And he gives me French, American, goes, and he says, Wolof. And I said, Wolof? Please don't tell me you're from the Wolof tribe. He goes, oh, yeah, my descendants are from the Wolof tribe. I'm like, oh, my goodness. I mean, I got goose hairs right now.
Me
okay?
too.
Because it was like we can't even write this up. And Anne Rice couldn't do a novel that could tie all these things together. So anyway, so I'm like, this, you know, that's completely incredible, but I'm there, and we want to tie the culture back, and then I meet Serene, and, you know, in my mind's just going that, man, Serene could be a great for our city, a gift to New Orleans, and to explore and to give the history to people of, you know, the cooking that we got. Now, we have a lot of French infusion into our cooking, but the French got their infusion from the Senegalese and the Gambian people. It was a circle that was just unexplainable. And again, I don't take any credit for it. I was a small cog in it, but I am so grateful that I got to play a small role in bringing him here because just love him to death.
What are you hoping for Serene ultimately?
Ultimately, I'd love to see him own his own place. You know, it would be so unique to have somebody that, you know, from that part of Africa to own their own restaurant and just be highlighted. And he's not just a good cook. He just loves to explain, you know, why he's using certain ingredients. And people really are interested in that now. So I think he brings New Orleans. He's a gift to New Orleans. He really is. And I hope that he decides to call this home for quite some time.
Thank you, Cliff. Thanks so much for bringing Serene to New Orleans and for visiting with us on Louisiana Eats.
It's my pleasure.
Cliff Hall, co-owner of the New Orleans Fish House. For a final take on Serene's extraordinary journey, we headed straight to the kitchen at Commander's Palace to speak with executive chef Tori McPhail.
My name's Tori McPhail. I'm the executive chef at Commander's Palace, and my friend Serene has worked for us now for maybe almost a year. Great, great, great guy.
There just seems to be such a magical thing about Cliff Hall, who works so closely with you all and has for years at the New Orleans Fish House, finding Serene in Africa and delivering him to you. It was better than a big tuna, huh?
I'll tell you what. It is an absolutely amazing story. And, you know, all of us in the food business, you know, behind the scenes, we work like heck to try to do everything we possibly can for the city. And although we do different things, we might have on different uniforms, it is very much a people's business. And so I highly respect Cliff and all the hardworking guys at the New Orleans Fish House. We've been wonderful friends for probably 20 years, you know, even going back to like the Jamie Shannon days. So he and I have been dear friends, and he calls me up one day and says, hey, Tori, look, I've got a little unusual story for you. And he starts launching into this remarkable story about Serene, how we met him in an airport. Understanding it, he's like, Tori, man, I really want him to come to New Orleans and fulfill some of his dreams, and I really want him to work at Commander's Palace. Would you please help me do that and facilitate, you know, making this kid's dreams come true? And so I said, Cliff, absolutely. You're a great, great buddy of mine. I'll do anything I possibly can for you. And so I ended up calling him up, We chatted on the telephone. He came down to New Orleans, and we hit it off immediately.
Tell me what it was like when you first met him face-to-face. Because, you don't know, you talk to him on the phone, and sometimes, you know, the phone, you make one impression, but then you get that face-to-face.
Yeah, Serena's a very good guy, but like anything else, whether you're buying fish or cars, you know, you hear one thing over the telephone, but you just never know what you're going to get until, you know, you're right there and in the moment. And when I shook hands with him and we make eye contact and, you know, firm handshake, and he started telling me his own story, it was pretty remarkable. So I said, look, I will do anything I possibly can for you. You know, it hasn't always been easy. You know, walking in and feeling a pair of clogs and feeling a cook's position on the roster at Commander's Palace is a very daunting thing. So it has not been an easy road for him personally, obviously. But professionally, it's not been easy either. But he has been a good study. The guy knows nearly all the stations in the Commander's Palace kitchen. A very, very, very quick study. Reminds me a lot of myself when I look in the mirror. And he is really, you know, knuckled down. And he says, you know what, I'm going to come back and I'm not going to make those mistakes again. And he's just, you know, that drive and determination in the face of adversity really says a lot about somebody's personality and what they bring to the table. He's the almost the first one in, the last one to leave, hardworking guy. And he's so driven, and he's such a family guy, which wasn't always part of his story. And so to see where part of his paycheck, a good part of his paycheck goes every single payday to really help his family, give back to the community, and pay it forward 1,000-fold is just, I don't know if he'll ever tell you that, but it's just really remarkable story that I encourage other people to get out there and introduce yourself to Serene. He's a wonderful guy. You know, he's a very emotional guy, right? He draws from his life experiences, and he channels that into becoming a better person every single day, personally and professionally. And, you know, the cooks know his story, and his story is starting to get out there more and more, and he's really becoming a recognizable face for Commanders as well. Really an amazing young success story. And so, you know, there's been other times, and we've had a not-so-great conversations at 11 o'clock at night in, you know, Ella's backyard behind Commander's Palace. And there's been some you know, tough, tearful conversations. But he comes in the next day, and he puts on his clogs and he puts on his apron like anybody else, and he says, you know what, I'm going to do this. And so now he's really becoming like a kind of an emotional leader in the kitchen, and taking some of the younger ones that, you know, he sees parts of himself in them, and really kind of taking them under his wings and saying, come on, let me show you what's going on. And it doesn't matter if it's a young pastry cook, or somebody working hot apps, or somebody working the line. He's really got that mental toughness to go above and beyond and really have that human connection to people.
Is there anything that you can tell me that he's taught someone?
I think it's the personal toughness and professional discipline is the biggest thing. As an example, you know, if I kind of bust his chops about, you know, he's got a messy station, or his apron's dirty, or he's just not quite as focused as he needs to be, you know, he's harder on himself than any of the rest of us. And so to see him walk back in and take his time, choose his words carefully, be very professional with some of the younger folks that don't have the professional advantages that he has had, his life disadvantages have made him the perfect mentor for some folks that maybe take life for granted a little bit. And to hear his story and have him relate about where he's come from and stand up at our, we call them premium meetings. It's where we get together and we talk with all the chefs and the cooks every day, twice a day, before the shift starts. To hear him say, hey, look, these are the keys to success. It's communication, hard work, focus, attention to detail, tasting your food. Everybody takes notice because he kind of sounds like he's almost a young sous chef or a young chef de partie. So, you know, everybody needs to watch out and kind of take notice of Serene, because he's coming up through the ranks at Commander's Palace and in New Orleans very quickly.
Thank you, Tori. Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Tori McPhail, Executive Chef at Commander's Palace. Did you know that New Orleans' famed beignets actually come from Africa, not France? Stay tuned, and we'll tell you all about it when we come right back.
I'm Cecil Doyle. Since the latter part of the 1980s, Earthbeat has been spotlighting sounds from around the world, from field recordings to classic vinyl to some of the latest smashes on the international scene. Join us for Earthbeat, Sundays 7 to 8 p.m., Thursdays 10 to 11 p.m., right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
We dig into the archives for Willie Nelson playing live in our studios and talking about the Texas Cotton Patch as an opera of voices. Then it's fellow traveler, country singer Margot Price, on lyrics that critique American life while supporting women and the working class. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Coming up Friday afternoon at 1, right after the Blues Box, here on KRVS.
Hello, everyone. This is Sadie, letting y'all know that my new show, Off the Tracks, airs on Thursdays at 10 p.m. on 88.7 FM or online at krvs.org. And if you missed the show, just go to krvs.org to listen to it on demand.
Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. Did you know that New Orleans' famed beignets actually come from Africa, not France? Chef Serene Mabe shocked both Cliff Hall and me with that news. I did some research on the topic, and yes, it turns out that an ancient beignet ancestor does survive in West Africa, where it's still a popular street food. There, they're called puff puffs, beaufrot, togbe, or beignet. So were the first beignets in New Orleans prepared by the French or by the West African slaves? There's a whole lot more research that needs doing to figure that one out. I'm Poppy Tooker, and no matter what you call them, beignets are real Louisiana eats.
I am Rick Blunt, and I am the CEO of Antoine's Restaurant.
I'm Sterling Constant, and I've been a waiter here for 50 years.
What do Bob Hope, Jackie Gleason, and former Governor Edwin Edwards all have in common? They've all been served by Sterling Constant at Antoine's in the French Quarter. And if you stop by today and are lucky enough to get Sterling as your waiter, you can expect the same level of service they received. 2017 marked Sterling's 50th year in service at Antoine's, which makes him the restaurant's longest-serving employee. To celebrate this milestone, Antoine's threw quite a party. Following the festivities, we visited Sterling along with Antoine's CEO, Rick Blunt, to discuss Sterling's remarkable career. When Antoine's had their big 50th celebration party for you, tell me about your customers who came. They came from everywhere, didn't they?
Yes, ma'am. They from all over, you know. I thought I was going to get time to eat, but I didn't. You know, greeting everybody, taking pictures with everybody was a big deal, you know. I've served many, many parties, large parties, but it was nothing like the one I had.
I wish other people in the country could have seen the customers who came out on a rainy Sunday afternoon to honor, to have dinner with and honor their waiter. I mean, where else in the world does that happen but New Orleans?
Now, Sterling, let's go back again to the very, very beginning. How old were you when you started working at Antoine's?
I was 16 when I started in the kitchen in 1967.
And why did you come to work here? How did you happen to get that job?
Tom, my cousin was a chef, Leroy Martin. And he said, well, come on, I'm going to get you a job over here. So I came with him, and I got stuck here for 50 years. It was like having glue on my shoes. I worked for his grandfather, for Ricky's grandfather, Mr. Roy. Then about 1972, I told the chef, I said, I'm coming out into the dining room. So he said, all right. So ever since then, I worked with him. The older waiters, they took you like a baby and showed you the proper way of doing things and serving customers and greeting customers. You know, that's the pride. You know, people today ask you, who's the most famous person you served? At the time, if I'm serving her, it would be her. I don't put a movie star in front of any of the guests. It's the guests that I'm serving is important to me.
Tell me what the kitchen was like when you came to work here as opposed to what it looks like today.
You know, when I came to work here, everything was done vertically, nothing by computers. So that's why a lot of the older waiters did everything by sight and memory. So, you know, you get parties, you don't write anything down.
Oh, my gosh. That's quite a memory trick, huh?
Yeah. There's a little memory to it. To this day, people come in and they're amazed that if you got four or five people, you don't write anything down. Or you're going to get it right, they ask you. I said, well, I think I might be able to do it. After 50 years, it's easy.
Tell me what your average day is like at Antoine's. Is there an average day?
My average day, 12 to 14 hours sometime. You know, I hear on TV, the youngsters say, I can't work more than 40 hours. I say, in the olden days, how the waiters and people that work jobs work 12 and 14 hours and never complain. Now, if they work more than 40 hours, they complain.
That's a lot of hours on your feet.
Right.
Here you are in the oldest continuously operating family-owned restaurant in the whole nation. That alone must give you a great deal of pride.
Yes, ma'am. Well, when he becomes the owner of the restaurant, I'll be on the fourth generation of the family.
Oh, my goodness. What are some of the more distinct requests or expectations that some of your customers have?
Well, a couple of times I did. The customer come in and said, I'm getting engaged tonight. What can you do to present her the ring? I said, well, let me think. I said, oh, we got a glass bell. I'll put the appetizer on the glass. I'll put the bell underneath it and put the ring in the center. And when she opened it up, oh, you know, you get an expression. Oh, this is so nice. You know, we used to do the mushroom underneath the glass bell, sucre, with the pâté. And that was one of the delicious dishes. And I remember Mr. Goss, who was the Attorney General of the state of Louisiana, he called up one day. He asked for a certain sauce on top of the lamb, and nobody knew how to make it. So he called downstairs. He said, ask Sterling. Sterling knows how to make that sauce, I'm telling you. So a guy comes and he says, Sterling, how you make this? Mr. Billy wants a maison d'or. I said, all right. I said, get some cherry wine, get some chicken breast and some sweet bread and cut it up in pieces and make your Bushmill sauce with sherry wine and put it on top of the lamb and some truffles in the sauce. That was the maison d'or.
And you just had that in your memory?
Everything comes back to me by memory. You know, like some of the old customers say, oh, we sure like to have the Oyster Alice. I said, well, if you tell me in advance when you're coming, I'll get the chef, which is Skeeter, at nighttime. He makes all the sauces. He knows how to make the Ellis. I said, I'll get it made for you.
So, Rick, tell us about your earliest memories of Sterling, because I guess, even though you grew up here, Sterling may have spent more hours in this restaurant than you.
Sterling spent multiples of the hours that I've spent in this restaurant, especially because I was missing. But Sterling started before I did. Sterling started in 67. I didn't start until 72.
You know, Sterling was already just moved into the dining room when I started. So Sterling, but Sterling had a little boys in those days. You know, he was a little kid, and so I, you know, I remember Sterling cutting up and stuff as a little boy. And, you know, today you look at both of us and we're old men. It's not, you know, it's not quite the same picture as it was then.
Rick, do you believe that there are young men and women today coming up in the ranks who will be the next Sterling? Do you see that continuity, or has the world changed?
No, I actually do see the continuity. And for a while I was really worried about it, but I'm now convinced that that the continuity is there, that New Orleans is there. Antoine's is not for everybody, but for the people who do fit within our culture, they tend to stay a whole lifetime, which I think is interesting. Number one, you can make a real living as a waiter at Antoine's. It's not a crummy job. It's a good career to have. And secondly, it's an honorable career to have.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for spending this time and sharing this legacy with my Louisiana Eats listeners. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ms. Poppy, it's always our pleasure. Thank you.
Sterling Constant and Rick Blunt of Antoine's. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. If you're not podcasting yet, it's time to subscribe. We've launched an exclusive podcast series, Louisiana Eats Quick Bites, made up of sneak previews of material that hasn't hit the airwaves yet and full-length interviews never heard on the show before. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from Dickie Brennan Steakhouse, a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef and Louisiana Wagyu in New Orleans French Quarter. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.